The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to welcome our guests. Hailed by Nicole Dennis Benn as one of the most gut-wrenching, soul-stirring, electrifying memoirs I've ever read, Safia Sinclair's How to Say Babylon recounts the author's struggle to break free from her rigid Rastafarian upbringing and her father's repressive control, set against the backdrop of a larger story of colonialism in Jamaica. Sinclair is also the author of the acclaimed poetry collection, Cannibal, winner of a Whiting Writers Award, and the American Academy of Arts and Letters Metcalf Award in Literature, and the Prairie Schooner Book Prize in Poetry, among other honors. The recipient of a Pushcart Prize and fellowships from the Poetry Foundation, McDowell and Yaddo, and the Bread Loaf Writers Conference, she teaches creative writing at the University of Arizona. This afternoon, Safia will be in conversation with Ara D. Matthews, the 2022-23 Philadelphia Poet Laureate. She is also the director of the poetry program at Bryn Mawr College. Her most recent collection, Bread and Circus, combines poetry, prose, and imagery to tell an intimate story about the author and her family. Please welcome Safia Sinclair and Ara D. Matthews.
Sophia, welcome to Philadelphia. Once again, you have killed it. I remember when your first book, Cannibal, came out. I think our books came out at around the same time. The first books came out at around the same time. Yeah. And I remember reading it and having that experience of Emily Dickinson. I'm sorry, I was going to give a quote from Emily Dickinson, but I'm not going to. But having that feeling of being, I don't want to use that same metaphor, having that feeling of being swept away by your language.
Thank you.
And it's that same feeling as I enter into How to Say Babylon. You can tell that this is a book in which you painstakingly considered language.
Yes.
In the form of a poet. I mean, it's a poet. It's how a poet, or how all should write a novel, really. We should all write in the vein of poets, right?
I agree.
And so I was wondering if you might open up for us just by giving us a little background, because it's not just the language that's remarkable and stunning. It's that you've done quite a bit of research for this book. So the way that I was noticing the way that you move through time and you cared to do research, obviously. And so I was wondering if you might just open it up a little bit.
Yeah, so, you know, the book is about my childhood and upbringing with Rastafari. And I knew that to be able to talk about Rastafari, that I was going to have to do research, because there is so much that I think people don't know about Rastafari, even though I think it holds this really big space in the global imagination, and cultural imagination. And most people, when they think of Jamaica, they think of Rastafari as the thing that kind of defines Jamaican culture. But Rastas are actually a persecuted minority historically in Jamaica. And the Rastas have always been outcasts. They've been pariahs. They've been, you know, turned away by their families, thrown out of their homes, forbidden from having jobs. And there is also no history book that exists, really, that talks about the formation of the Rastafari movement, the foundation of the Rastafari movement, going back to these ideas of Black liberation, of Pan-Africanism, and Marcus Garvey, and the Emperor Haile Selassie, who was, you know, the Emperor of Ethiopia, and Ethiopia was the only African nation to never be colonized, and that's why the Rastas hardened around Haile Selassie as the idea of this Black Messiah that was needed while Jamaica was still under colonial rule in the 1930s. And so a lot of this I knew I had to write about in the book, simply because there was no text yet that had all of this sort of put together to talk about Jamaican history in this way and Rastafari history in this way. So I myself had to become some kind of like Rasta scholar from scratch, strangely enough. There is no like Bible that Rastas, you know, there's no text that Rastas have. All of the wisdom is like oral, it's spoken, and it's like handed down from brethren to brethren. Unfortunately, it's also a very repressively patriarchal movement. So that wisdom was not passed down to women. I was never invited into the circle of men who were like passing down the wisdom of Rastafari. So I kind of had to find out a lot of it on my own while I was writing the book. I also, you know, called my brother and my father and asked them to fill in some of the gaps. So, but a lot of it comes from like oral, you know, oral history passed down.
In true African tradition, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
The griot and having the story told and the oral storytelling, how important that is.
Exactly. And going back to what you were saying about the language, like I really wanted those passages that were like historical context to read beautifully if they could. I didn't want them to seem like, okay, now I'm just dumping a bunch of facts and I have no care for the language of it. And so I spent a lot of time, probably the longest amount of time, like crafting and recrafting those sentences where I'm talking about the history.
I was wondering if you might be able to give our listeners here an example of how beautifully you melded the poetic with the prosaic and with research. So I was wondering if we might start off with an excerpt from The Man Who Would Be God.
I'll just read from this one, yeah. So The Man Who Would Be God is the first chapter in the book, and it describes Haile Selassie's visit to Jamaica for the first time. Haile Selassie was not a Rastafari. He was an Orthodox Christian, and so he visited Jamaica in 1966, and he met like hundreds of thousands of Rastas who believed he was the Black Messiah. And for me, it was like I couldn't pass up writing that and bringing that to life, you know? This like Rastafari lore, it's mythic almost in how he arrives and how much folklore was spun out of his visit, even though he said to them, I am not God, I am a man. But to the Rastas, they believed that only God would deny his divinity, and that only proved more that he was God. So the scene begins where they're sort of waiting for his plane to land. It was a very rainy day, and the Rastas have overrun the Jamaican government's very prim and pristine welcoming party that they had for Haile Selassie. The Rastafari were the nations downpressed and downtrodden, outlawed and persecuted since the Rastafari's movement creation in 1933. When a visionary street preacher named Leonard Percival Howell heeded Marcus Garvey's call to look to Africa for the crowning of a black king who would be the herald of black liberation. Howell followed Garvey's arrow back to the motherland and found Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia, the only African nation to never be colonized, and declared that God had been reincarnated, walking among them in the form of a black man born Rastafari Makanin. That was Haile Selassie's boyhood name. From the man came both myth and mountain, a seismic cultural shift that made the Rastafari a lasting colonial threat. It was a movement that hardened around a militant belief in black independence, inspired by Haile Selassie's reign, a dream of liberation that would only be realized by breaking the shackles of colonization and unifying the African diaspora. And though the Rastafari movement was nonviolent, they were the nation's black sheep, feared and despised by a Christian society still under British rule, forced to live on the fringes as pariahs. These were the involuntary landless and homeless, their encampment sacked, their fields burned by a government in service to the crown. When Howell built Pinnacle, the largest ever Rasta commune and a peaceful, self-sustaining society, the British government razed it to the ground, staunching the movement's message of unity and black independence. They were the unemployed and the unemployable, the constant victims of state violence and brutality, the ones the government jailed and forcibly shaved, the ones brutally beaten by the police. In 1963, when a group of Rastas refused to relinquish the farmlands they lived on to government seizure, Alexander Bustamante, the white prime minister then, ordered the military to bring in all Rastas dead or alive. This triggered a devastating military operation where Rasta communes were burned island-wide in a weekend of terror, where more than 150 Rastas were dragged from their homes, imprisoned and tortured, and an unknown number of Rastas were killed. For decades, they had been maligned as boogeymen, as madmen, as the monstrous Black Heart Man, a bloodthirsty caricature invented to scare children away from the Rastafari. They were kicked out of their homes, abandoned by their families, turned away at every door. So, when Rastas read the biblical accounts of Jewish persecution and strife, they recognized a similar suffering in their own tribulation. From those psalms of Jewish exile came the Rastafari's name for the systemically racist state and imperial forces that had hounded, hunted, and downpressed them. Babylon.
Thank you so much. Good question. So structurally, the book begins here. It starts with the historic 66 visit by Haile Selassie.
Yeah.
And then it ends in 2018, where you're in a sort of homecoming of sorts because you're at the mm-hmm. Calabash Festival.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm noticing these themes of homecoming in the beginning and then in the end. Even in most instances, yeah. It's kind of like a hesitant homecoming because Haile Selassie didn't want to get off the plane.
He was scared. I mean, at this point, he was like a frail 70, an old man in his 70s, and he was like, what is going on here?
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of frenzy and fervor, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you might talk to us a little bit about how you decided to structure the book and how those two anchor points, those two kind of instances in history, personal and the history of the Rastafari, how they serve as anchor points in grounding the narrative, the homecoming is grounding the narrative.
Yeah, you know, I'd never thought about it that way, that the book was anchored by these two moments. So now I should have just said yes. That was exactly what I was going for. But when I did think a lot about time and how I was going to write about time and moments in time as anchors for the narrative itself, places that, you know, would ground the reader in the book. And so those two moments, you know, the beginning where Haile Selassie lands in Jamaica and it's this really epic, like mythic moment.
Mm-hmm.
This grand moment of this man who, you know, for a long time when I was growing up, to me, just shaped the entirety of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Just the belief that my father had in him. I mean, we had posters and pictures of Haile Selassie in every house we lived in when I grew up. And, you know, I write that his face was more familiar to me than a grandfather.
Mm.
I saw the face of this man every waking day of my life. And so when I was thinking about writing the book, you know, he exists to me in that context, and I wanted to trace this, him coming in this very grand way, and sort of then kind of distill it down to how it's connected to me in our smaller moments, in our family, and everything kind of unravels from his landing, his coming, his influence, his existence.
Right.
And from there, my own life and my own connection to Rastafari developed.
How did you think about gathering the other time markers through the book? Mm-hmm. So when one's writing a memoir, you recognize that you won't be able to get everything in. And so how did you move through time? There was this masterful movement through time where in some chapters it moved to the next day, and in some there were these longer periods of time.
Yeah.
So how did you decide to use those markers?
I thought a lot about what I wanted the chapters to do. Mm. First of all, it's very hard to look at your own life and cut some of it out and be like,
yes,
that part's not important, you know? Because
yes,
it's all important.
Yes.
In sort of making us who we are full-bodiedly. So it was really hard to have objectivity, mm-hmm, in saying, like, this thing that really, really matters to me might not be as interesting to a reader. So it was something that I had to kind of learn and develop over the course of writing the book, but it was helpful to have an outline where I had these sort of touch points in my life that were accumulating to the larger narrative, and eventually, you know, this moment when I speak and I find this voice to kind of speak after decades of silence.
Mm.
And so I wanted to find places that dealt with that tension between the desire of wanting to speak, of wanting to celebrate my womanhood instead of being diminished by it after, mm-hmm, you know, years. And so what moments in my life, you know, would help to illuminate that? They were helpful to just find those moments and pinpoint them.
It was beautiful. There was this one moment early in the book, and it made me think about how your books deal with relationship and place, relationship to place, and relationship in places. And there was this moment where the four-year-old Sophia, mm-hmm, moved into the sea,
yeah,
against her father's wishes, and or warnings or admonitions, I should say. And so I wondered if that was the point of the first start of your quest for selfhood that you could remember, that moment of rebellion where you're like, mm-hmm, I'm going to do exactly what I want to do, even as a four-year-old. And if it wasn't then,
yeah,
then when was it?
You know, it's funny because the reason I walked into the sea is cut from the book.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
A lot of it, my editors were like, we could cut this, we could cut that. I'm like, are we sure? But, you know, I believed I saw my grandmother, and I walked toward her in the sea. And they were like, it's too much, and we don't need to know about your grandmother. And I was like, okay, well, she's gone. So I walk into the sea, and I start drowning, but it's this moment where my mother comes, and she saves me.
Mm.
And it's the first moment in the book where she saves me, but not the last. But it kind of, it introduces you to my mom, mm-hmm, and her character, who she's as a person, mm-hmm, and what our relationship is like.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like a good one to have there in the beginning. The first time that I began to question my father's rules,
mm,
I would say I was about 9 years old,
mm,
and my brother and I are 2 years apart in age, and for a long time we were like two peas in a pod, and you know, we would run around the yard, we would climb trees, we were wild children. We loved being out in nature and just being like little hooligans. And I remember a moment when I was 9 years old, and my father came to me and he said, "How tall are you now?" Right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, "My gosh, what have I done wrong?" Mm-hmm. In just in growing tall or just in getting older, I felt like I had done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And he said, "You're not, no girl child of mine is going to wear pants again." And he told my mother to throw out all the pants and shorts that we had in our house, and that me and my sisters would only wear skirts and dresses from now on that covered our knees, covered our arms. And that was the moment I began to question, because he also said I couldn't climb trees anymore. He said, "Now you need to be in the kitchen, watch what your mother is doing." But I saw none of that given to my brother. You know, like, he was still free to run wild and climb the trees. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment at nine I began to, you know, in the book I describe it as a seedling of a voice that said no. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. It's hard to constrain children because they want so desperately to be children.
Yes.
And you had the way that you portray yourself in the text, you had such a strong imagination and such a rich connection to land and to the landscape, mm-hmm. which helps the imagination as a child. And so, of course, you want to interact with it, right? It's hard to tell a child, "That's a tree, don't climb it.
But exactly, because you're a girl.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. But specifically because you're a girl, don't do it.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I noticed is that you had a very nuanced depiction of your father. So not only were you talking about his violences, but you also talk about his wounding from abandonment.
Yes.
And you deal with, I think, the root cause of the violences. And the question I have for you is, how do you hold space for people who, even in their best efforts, have harmed you?
I mean, it's a good question. I think I surprised myself in the writing of the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been thinking about writing the book for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. But the book that I would have written 10 years ago, I think would have been a different book than I wrote now, mm-hmm. with the time and distance that I had, you know, with my upbringing and all the things that happened, and the way that I feel about my father. I mean, it's every day it changes, it fluctuates. But when I was writing the book, what surprised me was I found myself becoming a forgiving person. And I did not expect that, because I would never describe myself as a forgiving person. But somehow in the writing of it and wanting to trace his introduction to Rastafari, how he came to it, I had to sit down and talk to him. I had to interview him. And so there was no way to do that without also sort of opening myself to listening to what he had to say, to humanize him in a way that I never had before. Or he had never really humanized himself to me either, because he loomed really large in our house as like the authority figure, and the rules came down from him. So I sat him down and I recorded lots of interviews with him where I asked him about his life. Well, how did you come to Rastafari, and how did your family react? And, you know, he described this scene to me where his mother, who is a very Christian woman, kicks him out of the house when he's like 16, 17 years old. And as he was telling it to me, he began to cry. And I had never seen that before. And it shocked me, surprised me, and I was also moved and hurt by what he was telling me. And there were these, you know, just talking to him that I felt for the first time we saw each other on this level that we hadn't before. And I knew then I wanted, however I described him in the book, for all his faults, all his flaws, all his violences, that I could also try to express his complexities as a human being, to trace his own familial wounds and his own traumas in trying to understand my own and in trying to understand this story and our lives and what I essentially wanted the book to do, which is to change that cycle. So that was really, you know, that was a very surprising thing.
Yeah, and one gets a sense as a reader that that happened internally, organically, genuinely, in time and over time.
Yeah.
It's not an easy process, and I imagine that in trying to understand people's complications or the complexities toward their human wholeness, we are sometimes on the receiving end of their, of some of their not greatest moments, right? So I wanted to ask you a question about your mom. You talked in the book about your mom, and I can understand, as someone who also suffered from domestic violence, how they're quieted in some kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if you were ever grieved by your mother's silences, and when did you come to understand the power of that silence?
Hmm. Yeah, you know, when you're a teenager, you don't always know how, like, the different ways that strength presents itself. Mm-hmm. So when I was a teenager, I was grieved. I was aggrieved a lot by her silences. I was like, why don't you ever say something? Because my way of dealing with things was so the opposite of hers. Just to just say the thing and explode, you know, like, let's just have it out. She was never like that. And I had to really learn that, and in the writing of the book as well, taught me more patience with my mother, right? Mm-hmm. I was always very impatient with her when I was younger and didn't understand why she did some of the things she did or why she didn't do some of the things. And so as I was writing the book, I began to realize, just by sitting with her, sitting with her own voice and sitting with all the things that happened and all the different ways that she saved me, that she had always been strong. I could pinpoint all these moments in my life where she was the one who had changed the course of the things that happened. You know, and she's the person who first gave me my first book of poems. She gifted me my love of poetry. She always had me and my siblings memorize and recite poems. She would do anything to, if I said to her, Mom, like, I want to go try modeling. And she would, like, somehow, I don't know even to this day how she convinced my father to let me go try it. But she did. Mm-hmm. But when I was 16, I couldn't see it. Like, but having to sit down and write it, I was like, wow, like, she really made some magic happen in my life. And I mean, all of this I owe to her. I would not be sitting here in front of you if it weren't for her.
Right. One of the things I learned, having met your mother, who's a lovely woman, one of the things I learned was that in the book, I was really paying attention with the eye of a mother.
Yes.
And as I was reading, there was something interesting I noticed happening in her silences, and that was attention. So she paid attention. So the mere fact that she bought you a book and then gave it to you, she noticed.
She did.
That you like to read, or that you would be a reader, or that you would be a poet. So it's something about the noticing and the attention that's so beautiful in the book, truly.
Yeah, and she noticed that I was hurting. Because that moment where she gives me the book, I was 10 years old, and a friend at school, who I thought was a friend, a girl, said, I don't want to be around you. I don't want to be your friend. I don't want to be friends with Arasta. And it was really, it hurt me. It was the first moment where I realized that the path I was on, because my parents were Rastafari, was going to be a hard one. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to do with that. And so I harmed myself. I didn't think anybody knew. I told them it was an accident, but my mom knew. Mm-hmm. And that's when she handed me those book of poems. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's such an important move. It was a book of Blake poems, wasn't it?
It was a book of poems called Poems from a Child's World. And it was full of not just Blake, but like poems like that, you know, the like the nice bucolic English countryside poem.
Do you remember one of them?
I remember the Blake poem, which was the tiger.
Yeah.
You know,
can you read a little
tiger,
bit?
Tiger burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye can frame thy fearful symmetry? So, you know, like that's a cute little poem. But for me, I was like, whoa.
Fearsome symmetry.
I was 10 years old. I was like, fearful symmetry.
Yeah.
And like the tiger burning bright. The imagery jumped out at me immediately. Mm-hmm. And I became fascinated with how Blake did that. And why did I keep, how I kept seeing this neon tiger in the forest. And then I went to the encyclopedia that we had at home. And I was like, I need to look up this William Blake. And I looked him up, and I saw that he had died almost 150 years ago. And I was like, whoa, that is the thing that shook me at 10, where I was like, it made me feel something. And he is gone, but his words lived. Right. And then I was like, poetry is the thing.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the immortality of language.
Yes.
And how it can still strike you.
Yes.
You talked a little bit later on about Walcott saying that a poem strikes you in the spine. It's not in the mind or the heart, but like in the spine.
Right. And that wasn't Walcott. That was the old poet.
Oh, that was old poet.
Quoting Nabokov.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yes, like poetry, that was the first moment where I kind of realized all the wonder and magic that language could weave in the world.
Yeah.
And I mean, the damage was done. There was no looking back after that.
Yeah.
Like, that was it. I'm a poet. Yeah.
But like speaking along those same lines, when you think about memoir, it kind of toes the line, it toes a boundary, right, between what part is your story and what part is someone else's story, where you start and where someone else ends.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry is really the navigator of that, right? So there's something in poetry that navigates that gap beautifully between the ending of you and the starting of someone else.
Yes.
And so I wanted to ask you, when did you feel free to cordon off the personal story and make it public? What happened for you where you said, this feels like it's something that 150 or 170 years later someone will come back to and they'll still find the spine-tingling beauty in it.
Hmm. You see how she's a poet, y'all? My God. And do you mean this book in particular? When did I decide?
Yeah, like when did you decide? It doesn't even have to be with the book, but like when did you decide that the personal story can actually be this complex vehicle by which other people can, who similarly suffer or similarly live, can find some respite?
You know, I have a lot of storytellers in my family, particularly the women in my family. My mother is an amazing storyteller. Mm-hmm. And I was with her this weekend. She was with me the last few days. And she just loves to tell me the stories of my life. Over and over again. And this weekend when I was with her, she'd be, I remember when that thing happened and you walked into the sea and you almost try to say, yes, mom, it's in the book. And then she said, and do you remember that time when you wanted to go to college and I did this? I say, yes, mom, it's in the book. And so to answer your question, that's why. Because so many of our stories exist in the oral tradition,
truly,
right? In this oral folkloric tradition, and my mom would tell me the stories over and over, and I don't want to lose them. I don't want to lose the history of my family. because there's so much in my family line. I don't know a lot about my family history. I don't know my great grandfathers, or I can't trace my family line. And so I've always been fascinated with making sure I write it down and document our lives and make a record of our lives, that we lived and we were here and we mattered, that the people in my family, the women of my family, who pushed their hands into the dirt and made everything possible for me, I want to pay tribute to them.
Absolutely.
And that's really why. And also thinking about the girls who come next, that I'm giving something to them also, right, so that they would never have to wonder or question where they came from the way I did. Mm-hmm. So they'll know where they came from, but they'll also know moving forward that the future is theirs for the making.
Right on. You talked about that too. In the book, at least in the acknowledgments, you talked about how for your niece, it's for who comes after, you know.
Yes.
It's at once, it's reaching back and reaching forward. That's the reason for the storytelling. It's that you're trying to reclaim some ancestral memory, but at the same time, you're trying to make space for who comes before.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's really beautiful.
Thank you.
Can I ask you one more question about language?
Please,
okay.
Yes.
So there's this move in the book where it's kind of this democratizing of language. There's no doubt about the way that you democratize language, because you've accepted kind of the creolization, or the eye for eye words, as your dad would have said, said in the book, and the colonial language. And they cohabitate together on the page without mediation, without need for translation.
Yes.
And I just wanted to know how liberating that felt, to speak in what you've heard, to hear and to speak in what you've heard and know that you'll be understood.
I mean, it was great, and it was very intentional. I wanted to make sure that I captured with as much authenticity as I could the way that the people in my family and in our lives spoke. And so that involves not only Jamaican Patois, but Rasta vernacular, which is very different from Jamaican Patois. And if you all have never sat down and talked to a Rasta brethren, like, you might not understand maybe 80% of what he says, because there's like a specific way that they speak that comes from an anti-colonial place, where the thought is to uproot everything connected to the English language and turn it on its head and say like the opposite, and not to say anything negative. So, you know, a Rasta man doesn't say understand, he says overstand. He doesn't say appreciate, he says appreciate love. And so, you know, my father speaks like this, and I can understand how he speaks. There's a lot of people that meet him and they're like, what is he saying? Like, what is he saying? But I understand it. A Rasta man also doesn't say me, he only says I and I, or the I, or I man. And so because Ja is always with the Rasta man, and it's not just an individual, it's a collective. So they have like all these very specific reasons for the way they speak, which fascinates me as a poet. Actually, my next poetry collection is about that, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about this. Okay. But so I really wanted to capture that, because this is just how my father spoke. Like, there was never to me any thought about changing it or explaining it.
Right.
You know,
like, and really, why should there be?
Why should there be?
It's understood.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that Gertrude Stein took liberty with language.
Yeah.
She didn't use question marks, and she said the question's understood.
Right.
So, read better.
Yes.
We're going to open it up for questions from the audience. I don't want to hog the conversation, but I do know that you all probably have some questions.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm so delighted to be here. I heard your interview on Fresh Air yesterday, and it was a wonderful preface. So I first just want to appreciate you for what you've done and how you've lived, and especially for what you said about your parents. So I have two, I'm cheating. I have two questions. You can answer both
or
whatever.
But that one was more of a comment, so I'll take it.
But so I have a poetry question.
Yes.
And a craft question.
Okay.
You sort of addressed the craft thing. So when I was listening to you yesterday, mm-hmm. and you talked about your mother's fingers.
Yes.
I was in the car, and I said to my husband, "Oh, my God, do you think she's read Lucille's poem?" So I wondered if Lucille Clifton, who has a poem called "I Was Born with 12 Fingers," had any resonance for you or impact on you, or if you encountered that work at any point in your maturation as a poet, just because it's about women, black women with six fingers and lineage and all that. And so so Clifton in general, but in particular, that poem. So I'll say my craft question and then I'll stop. So what does it say? Oh, how did poetry writing inform your turn towards memoir?
Thank you. You know, I love Lucille Clifton. Like, I quote her at the end of the book, and I love that poem and the way that she writes, like you say, about black women and about our bodies. And I thought it was so... I did not expect Terry to ask me about my mother's six fingers. Like, she has six fingers on each hand, but... And it's something that I love so much about her. I know I've written a poem to her hands that she loves, and she's like, "Remember that poem you wrote me?" Yes, Mom, it's in the book. Poetry. How did poetry
inform the memoir?
Oh my goodness. So for me, I really wanted the memoir to be an expansion of what I was already doing in poetry, right? Like, I was already writing about my family. I was writing about colonial wounds in Jamaica. I was interrogating our history with imperial forces in my poetry. I always wrote about my family with love, and wanted to trace my family history through poetry. I always wrote about selfhood and womanhood. And Jamaican womanhood in particular in my poem. So the memoir is very much an extension of all of those themes. But it also allowed me, writing in prose, allowed me to do a lot of things that I haven't done in poetry. And maybe, I guess I could. There's no rules. You could do whatever you want. But I wouldn't necessarily write dialogue in a poem. But the memoir gave me so much room to do things I've never done, like write scenes of dialogue where, you know, you can then hear the voice of my father in your own head. Sorry. And you can feel the landscape of Jamaica brushing against your skin. That you could feel the humid kiss of the air. You can understand how I felt when my mother rubbed my feet or pulled me in for a hug, that you could see the character, you could feel my family as full-blooded people. And I had, the memoir, it was a gift in that way, that it gave me even more space to be even more painterly and flesh out the people in my life through writing. And then there were definitely moments in the book where I wanted to really turn up the volume on the poetry. So there's some passages in there where I'm like, I'm just gonna go for it. I'm gonna talk about, describe hair for like 200 words, you know? So I tried to also find that balance of like when the poet jumps out on the page. Thank you.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for coming.
I first came to your work through the New Yorker article that I read recently. And I wonder, do you continue to model as you can also continue to write? And if you don't model, why not?
I don't model, no. Why not? I don't know. I guess we got to call like Wilhelmina Models and ask them. You know, it was interesting because there was this point in my life around 16, 17, where I was really serious about my poetry. And I felt at that age, the way that men in particular interacted with me, I worried that if I continued modeling, that what I had to say would not have been given the same kind of weight. And I had a lot to say, and I would rather say it with my words than through modeling. And so I just made this decision at 17. I was like, I'm not going to do it anymore. But I still love fashion and getting
She's
dressed
so
up.
Fashionable, seriously. I've never seen anybody dress better than Sophia. The history of fashion. Her sartorial choices are incredible.
I loved your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So it's a two-part question.
Okay.
But the first part was just, do you know if your father read it? And then the second part is, do you think that he still considers himself as full or as much Rastafari as he was when you were a child? Because it seems like he's changed towards the end, but I don't know if you would think he just changed because he's accommodating you in his life or if he's fully changed his idea of Rastafari as well.
Has he read it? He asked me for the book a couple months ago after the New Yorker article came out. And the fact checker at the New Yorker called everybody in my family, my father, my siblings, my mother, my grandmother, who was like mentioned in one line. And apparently the Rastafari men in, sorry, not men, brethren, the Rastafari brethren in Montego Bay have a group chat. And they were dropping links to the article in the group chat. And my father was very excited about this, and he asked me if he could read the book. I said, of course, yes, sure, you can read the book. And when he began reading it, he would call me like every 10 minutes, like, oh, like it wasn't exactly, I wasn't born exactly in the country. I was born at Victoria Jubilee Hospital at 5 p.m. I was like, okay, but I'm not gonna put that in the book. So then I said to him, please, I don't wanna talk. Can I just ask you, like, can we not talk about this book until you finish it? And he said, okay. And I haven't heard from him yet, so I don't know if he finished it, but that was what I asked him. Is he still Rastafari? Yes, he would say he's Rastafari to the bone. Absolutely. I think that, you know, he really, in his mind, wanted this perfect Rastafari family. I think, and not to like analyze my father, but I'm gonna analyze my father. I think because he didn't have his own sense of family growing up. He was always alone. He didn't know his father. His mother was always gone. He kind of saw us as the family he was building for himself. And I think he just took that way to the extreme. But because of that, we left, you know, and my sisters are gone and I'm gone. And I think that softened him. So he is different in the way that he's more open to listening, that he can see me for who I am as a person and not necessarily an extension of what he wants me to be. And so that's growth, you know. I think if I told my 16-year-old self that he would be that person, I'd be surprised. But I'm happily surprised, but still Rastafari to the bone.
I'm going to go ahead and take the last question. Since we're talking about the Rastafari, you were saying that, I mean, we know that you came up in the tradition and that with any childhood dogma, there's a certain embeddedness that follows us throughout our lives, even if we've broken away from it to some degree. So I wanted to ask, where are you now with your balancing of the spiritual and the secular?
Oh, Era, you're asking like the hard question. Well, you know there's a scene in the book where I just... I won't spoil it. But I declare in a very public manner what I think about it all. I'm not a very spiritual person. I mean, I'm a poet, so to me that is my own form of prayer. Poetry to me is what connects me to what I imagine is a spiritual world. That you know, where I feel like I could step into spaces where I don't necessarily understand and go through processes where I don't necessarily understand, and then I have something beautiful. Mm. That's spiritual.
Yeah, it is.
So, yeah. Wow, okay, yeah. I'm spiritual.
You're spiritual.
Yes.
It's an act of creation. You know what I mean? It's an act of creation.
Poetry is an act of creation. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here today,
you.
Sophia. It was beautiful to spend time with you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you all for coming out.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.